We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We will introduce our guests momentarily, but I first wanted to give a shout out to our sponsor, Chessable.com. Chessable, as you guys know, is coming out with new courses constantly that are well worth checking out, and I wanted to highlight a few from recent guests of the pod. First of all, Endgame Labyrinths by Stefan Nielsen, the excellent compilation of endgame studies, is now available on Chessable. That one's for advanced players, but it's great for the Chessable format because these are challenging and instructive and beautiful endgame studies, but they are worth review because they there's a lot of unique patterns when you're studying this sort of puzzle. And then from the beginner perspective, we have recent guest Grandmaster Josh Friedel's course available. There's lots more coming on the way. Some of hope to interview some fun guests with Chessable courses on the way, so be sure to check them out. And if you sign up for Chessable Pro, please use the link in the description to help support Perpetual Chess. As for this week's guest, she has worked in... So her background started out outside of chess. She worked in business writing and research before transitioning to the nonprofit world, but she's been teaching chess for decades in and around Brooklyn, New York, where she was born, raised, and lives. She's taught many future masters and has worked closely with Bruce Pandolfini, was one of the first teachers of five-year-old Fabiano Caruana, as we will discuss, and her new book, Strategic Moves, Mind-Bending Exercises for Kids, will be out, I think, the day that this podcast comes out, certainly in short order by the time you hear this. And it shares advice for teachers and kids based on her decades teaching chess. As someone who has taught a lot of chess classes myself, I really enjoyed reading and hearing our guests' reflections. So without further ado, I would like to welcome to the show Carol Ann Caronia. Welcome, Carol Ann.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited to chat. I really enjoyed the book. So this episode, for listeners, I think it'll be of most value to parents and educators, you know, people running chess clubs and stuff like that. But Carol Ann's got some fun stories in the book that we will be getting into in due time. But Carol Ann, I thought it would be most helpful if we maybe started with some tips. We have a lot of chess educators who listen to this show and a lot of chess parents, and you share reflections sprinkled throughout the book for both. And I have specific questions related to it, but I thought maybe it would be helpful to start with a big picture look at sort of your top advice. And why don't we start with for chess teachers, for people running chess clubs? What advice would you give to someone who either feels like they could be better or is possibly new to the endeavor?
The best advice for someone running a chess class, make sure they're having fun. Okay, yes, you want the work to get done. You want them to learn. You want them to be good chess players. But as I talk about in the book, this is a market-driven endeavor. And if they're not coming to the class, nobody's learning anything. So you have to make sure they're having fun in class.
Yeah,
I used to have a motto, learn and have fun.
Yeah, that's great advice and something I certainly experienced. Because when we get into chess teaching, often it's like we love this game and we're so eager to share the ideas. But as you write about in the book, like the kids have been in school all day, you know, often if you're doing an after school program. And they want to play.
Yes, and chess is a game.
Yeah, well said. That is something I definitely, you know, so one thing I did when I was running a lot of after school programs is I did try to teach them in like a sort of a lecture format. I tried to keep it extremely short. I tried to keep it to about 10 minutes. But I also tried to read the room. And depending on, you know, some days where they don't have recess or always terrible, stuff like that. What is your approach? Like, are you doing instructive periods at all when they come into the club? I know you mentioned that you have in the book that you have the chess that's already set up, or do you have them play from the beginning?
There are two answers to that question, because at the beginning of any session, any trimester, I've got at least two groups of kids in the class, sometimes three. The kids I know how to play, who can start playing immediately, the kids that don't know how to play, and the ones that fall somewhere in between. So the ones that know how to play go directly to playing, and the ones that don't know how to play get 15, 20 minutes of instruction on how to play the game. I find they will not sit for instruction once they know how to play. They want to kill each other on the chessboard. That's what they're there for, and that's what they want to do.
Yeah. Okay, a couple follow-ups on that, because you put things in a perspective I hadn't thought about. I also, when I taught, had the experience where kids tell you that they know how to play, but they really don't. And
right.
Obviously I picked up on this, but I never was consciously calling them out on it. Whereas you talk about in your book where you tell them like, no, I don't believe you.
Yes.
What brought you to this approach?
I'm honest with them generally. I know I'm just up front. If they think they can, a lot of them will try and get anything over. Maybe because I'm a woman. And I'm, you know, the class is filled with aggressive little boys, but they will steamroll me any chance they get. So I have to make sure they know I'm not easily steamrolled. And I'll just tell them, no, I don't believe anyone. You're going to have to show me. And then I make them prove it.
Yeah, and this helped me make another connection. You mentioned in the book, I think you compare it to something like chutes and ladders. And when I play like family game night with my kids, I found that when my son tries to tell me the instructions for a game I haven't played, I have a hard time listening. And
right.
I'm sort of like, I'll just figure it out as we go. And
right.
generally that is an effective strategy. But as you point out in the book, it's not as effective for chess. And I hadn't made the connection that kids could be approaching it the same way that I sometimes do.
Yes, you're exactly correct. So, but you have to keep that instruction short and light. And I am not one ever, Ben, that gives gratuitous presents to children for doing nothing. Okay, if you give something from me, you've earned it. So, but while they're learning, I will give them tiny little stickers. I think I mentioned that in the book also.
Yeah.
Mainly, honestly, to keep track of who's given me an answer, because not one child is going to monopolize all the answers. I want even the shyest, quietest child in the class to have as many turns as that the one that wants to tell you everything.
Yeah, we do live in a trophy culture these days, so it's a challenge. But I commend you. I I probably gave out too many prizes in my day, I have to admit.
Yeah. No. They would, I used to run tournament classes, particularly at Congregation Beth Elohim, where there was a winner for every trimester and one for the entire year. So I could keep track of who's winning what on a daily basis and for the trimester, and then add those all up and there'd be a winner for the year. They would get trophies.
Yeah. Yeah, well-deserved, and obviously that gets them super excited. And we should say for context, what are the ages that you're primarily teaching, Caroline?
From about 4 to about 11.
Okay, yeah.
I kind of specialized in the younger ones.
Okay.
You know, the 4 to... not many people are teaching children that young, but not to say I didn't... teach the older ones. I did.
But of course, stickers get less effective as the kids get older.
Yes, they do.
Any other? So of course, I agree with your main advice that it has to be fun. That you know, that is the most important thing. But any other advice you would
for teachers,
impart?
For parents?
Let's stick with teachers for now.
For teachers?
Yes.
Just as we were talking about before. About giving those short lectures at the beginning, drop them. Nobody wants to hear them. They're not listening and they're not learning. Virtually all the instruction I gave individually as they were playing the game. In other words, you've got 10 games going, maybe 20 kids, and you're walking around the room. I got more aerobic exercise during chess classes than I do on my morning walks. You're walking around the room, you're monitoring the games, there's your opportunity to teach. And that's one of the things about chess that is so useful, in that I can tell a kid, don't drop out of high school. But, you know, that's 10 years down the line, they're going to see the effects. When I tell them, play for the center, and they're playing on the flanks, that effect is immediate. So you have your chance to do the instruction on an individual basis. They don't even know they're being taught, okay, as you're walking around the room and seeing what they're actually doing in the game.
And you mentioned in the book that the clubs are typically an hour long. So Do you just have them play for the whole hour? I mean, obviously, as you say, you're giving instruction on an individualized basis during that period, but is the only activity them out with chess sets?
For the older kids, yes. First through sixth graders, yes. The younger ones, no. Because they cannot sustain the concentration for that long.
Yeah, that's been my experience as well. So how do you mix things up with the younger kids?
Well, I have my lesson for the day. Like, today we're going to learn pawns. Okay? For the youngest who know how to play already, they just sit down like everybody else and play for a half hour, 40 minutes, however long they can do that. And the other ones that are teaching, they get one lesson. That are learning, they get that one lesson. Let's say how this is how pawns move. And then I sit them down at the board and make them actually move the pawns. I make the analogy in the book that it's like, I can tell you how to ride a bike, but until you put your feet on the pedals and push, you're not riding. I can tell you how the pawn moves, but until you put your hands on the pawn and move it, you're not playing with them.
Yeah.
So after the playing session, however, with the younger ones, then we move to at least one or two other activities.
Which would be what, like puzzle sheets or mini games or what?
For the younger ones, I give them mazes.
Yeah, they love the mazes.
Yes, but, you know, they're a good educational tool if you use it properly.
Yeah. And Caroline, so what about for people listening who are not running school chess clubs, but maybe occasionally find themselves teaching, whether it be their own kid or someone in the family, chess from scratch? You talk in the book about the order you teach the pieces in. What recommendations would you give for people sharing their love of chess to a brand new young student?
Well, you're a dad. Did you teach your son to play?
I did, yeah. I taught my son and my daughter. And yeah, I followed the same piece order that you lay out. Pawns, then rooks and bishops, then queens. I can't remember if I do kings or knights. It's been a while, but those two are last.
Right. And I would do that also. But dads and sons, I found, are often problematic. And I can't stress this enough to any dad I talk to who plays chess, because dads have a tendency to not know whether to win all the time mm-hmm. or to lose all the time. If you win all the time, that kid never expects to win anything. And if you lose all the time, they have no idea they can ever be beat. And that first loss is extremely traumatic. So you have to find an in-between way. I could recommend at least two ways, and I think this is very important. One way is for the dad, if you get a winning position, to turn the board and give the child the winning position. And the other way is to play against a computerized program where you can set the level, you can turn the board, you can take back bad moves, and you can play together as a team.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
I don't usually find that with mothers or grandfathers. Grandfathers are very good. But I would recommend that for teaching purposes.
Yeah, like playing against the kids love the chess kid bots. And yeah, I've mentioned this on the podcast before, Carol Ann, but I had the exact experience you described where I figured I'm a chess master. I shouldn't, you know, my son might think it's odd if he's beating me,
right.
You know?
Right.
So I gave it some thought, but decided I shouldn't let him win. But I actually think part of the reason he doesn't play tournaments or anything mm-hmm. is because I showed him no mercy when he was six and I regret it.
Yes. Well, that's, as I said, it's hard either way.
Yeah.
And I don't think dads realize it when they're doing it. They're trying really to be helpful to their child.
Yeah.
So that's why I offer the alternatives.
Yeah. And my daughter, who's now seven, like, I don't want to paint in broad brushstrokes. I'm just talking mm-hmm. about her specifically. But
right.
she's decided that she's just not competitive generally,
right.
and that makes it challenging to, like, she might be just as interested in doing puzzles or something like
right.
that as playing a game. What experiences can you share about, like, differences between how boys and girls enjoy chess?
There are many girls who can, you know, hang out with the best of the boys. Some can't, like your daughter. For those like your daughter, who don't particularly want to be competitive, I would pick up my 60 memorable games and play them together and show her the joy of and the beauty of someone like Fischer. That would be a good advice from me. So she's learning the game, but it's not in a competitive way.
Yeah. I think that's good advice. And how does that manifest in the classroom?
I write a lot about this. At least there's one chapter on girls and chess. And while they're learning and answering the questions and doing the moves in a group situation, they're wonderful. But as soon as they start getting competitive, some immediately find defenses to that. Like they want to play their girlfriends and then nobody does anything. You know, they're just moving pieces around the board. Or they will not play the winning move. They object to capturing their opponent's pieces. They won't do it. And so they wind up, you know, with an empty board and the king being chased around by a few rooks. So you have to be sensitive to where they're at. And maybe they're not coming back. Okay, but you should make sure they have a positive experience as much as possible.
Yeah, a few things that you wrote about that resonated with me. Number one, I liked where you wrote that you viewed it as part of your job to teach the girls to compete with the boys, because obviously
right.
as life goes on, you know, boys can continue to attempt to sort of dominate a classroom. And whether they stick with chess or not, that they it's a helpful life skill to learn to be vocal and to know that they can, you know, that they're just as good, if not better. So I really appreciated that, Carolyn.
One of the people I wrote about, I call, I think, Miss Z the Elder. Mm-hmm. And I wrote about how she had graduated college and asked me what she even worked with me in the classroom. She came and helped me teach on more than one occasion while she was in high school. She asked me what was the most important thing I could teach girls. And I said, how to compete against boys. Well, you'll be happy to know she's taking her PhD in physics. And one of the reasons is she wants to teach girls how to do science and compete with the boys. Yay!
Yeah, I love it. That's great. And another point that really resonated with me as I reflected on when I was running after school chess clubs is you talked about how conscious you are of like which girls get paired with who. And it made me realize this is something I probably could have been better at. Like you kind of have in mind who the girls are who are competitive and can, you know, don't need any sort of selection. You also made me realize like I should have been more attentive to the girls who were playing with their friends. And as you say, sort of going out of their way not to compete when they played against each other. But I also appreciated the advice you gave about like looking for girls who could handle playing against certain kids, and you can pair them with certain kids, and the kids don't know why, but that's a way of encouraging them if you know that the boy they're playing is not particularly obnoxious, for example.
Yes, and that's a stopgap measure until they start to get used to the competition and can tune out the, I don't know what the right word is, from the boys, the noise from the boys. And that's a learned activity also. But if you pair them against someone who's not going to be that, as you said, obnoxious initially, then they can grow slowly into a more competitive role. Some of them will never get there, but you have to be able to at least nurse that along.
Yeah, it's a constant challenge, but I learned a lot from reading your book and really appreciated your advice. We'll be right back with more teaching advice from Carol Ann Caronia.
If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
And we are back. Another strain that I'm curious to hear your reflections on, Carol Ann, are how to continue once your kid does show an interest in chess. Are you coaching tournament players very often? And what have you observed about the sort of tournament culture in New York where it's obviously very competitive?
I think there are two layers of chess players, okay? There are those who want to go on to play in tournaments, and those who, you know, just want to have fun. And they'll be playing with their brothers for the rest of their lives, you know. The kids that want to go play in tournaments. There, you can even make distinctions between them because their parents have to have enough time and money and desire to get them to those tournaments. Okay? Never mind the kid has to be able to emotionally withstand the rigors of tournament play and the study that's necessary to do that. But it's a tremendous commitment. The three students that I've had that have won either national or international glory, there was nothing but chess. There wasn't baseball. There wasn't football. There wasn't hockey. There wasn't anything but let's study chess and play chess. And it's a financial and emotional commitment by the parents. So even if the child might want to do it, the parents may not have enough resources unless a school has received funding or there's some patron somewhere. Did that answer the question?
Yes, for sure. Yeah. And so as we mentioned in the introduction, one of Carol Ann's earliest students was Fabiana Caruana. And you mentioned in the book, you also, these future national champions, you mentioned Sean and Robert, but you don't say their last names. And as someone who follows the chess world closely, I was just curious if you can reveal them.
Well, you know, I didn't want to give last names of any of the students that I taught, even when they were very close to me. Robert Mesa is now, not only has his MD, but he has a few other advanced degrees. I think he's in Ohio working on public health or epidemiology post-COVID, getting another PhD there. So he's doing very well.
That's awesome.
He played through college. I'm not sure he had any time in med school or after that to do any serious playing. Sean Dobbin is a reporter for the AP, and his father also is, I think he's station chief up there in Rochester. I'm not sure whether he plays at all or not. Probably plays some.
That's great. And when you were teaching, so you taught Fabiano when he was five, is that right?
Right, kindergarten. Now, I must say, Fabiano came to me, as did Robert and Sean, knowing how to play the game, okay, and knowing how to play pretty well. What I worked on with Fabiano, and he may not even realize it, is teaching those logic and critical thinking and problem-solving skills that I feel are applicable no matter what you do in life. And then when we went to a certain degree, then Bruce took over and taught him there for a while, for 3 years or so.
Yeah, we should be clear for context. You're not talking about teaching Fabiano, saying like I taught him everything he knows. It's just it's just a fun slice of life thing that you encountered this kid who went on to become.
As Bruce says, I recognize the talent.
Yes, yeah. So what stood out about him, or did something stand out about him even at that young age?
Oh, absolutely. One of the ways that I spot talent, and not all of it turns into chess talent, is you've taught chess classes. Are they quiet?
No, I appreciated you were talking about how loud they were.
Right. But if you get a kid who in the midst of that chaos can hold the concentration on the board, make good moves, and win the game, then you know you have something there. And Fabiano certainly could do that. He could tune out any chaos that was going on around him and win the game. We would get to a point where I would have him do what I would call a doubleheader, all right, because he's beating everybody in the class. All right, we'll beat two people simultaneously. Beat three people, okay? And never a break in the concentration at all. He was not there to make friends.
And so I was going to ask if he showed a particular enthusiasm, but you describe almost more of like a business-like mindset,
yes,
even at the age
absolutely.
Of five.
Yes, absolutely. I agree with that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I interviewed this famous chess trainer named Jakob Augard, who was talking about how elite players are different from even other grandmasters. And mm-hmm. he said that they're all sharks. So
yes.
So you would say, and it's funny because Fabiano is very gentle mannered, you know, in disposition, right. But obviously hyper competitive.
And focused.
Yeah. So then you passed him along to Bruce Pandolfini, and the legend goes from there. And Bruce, of course, discussed it in my interview and in many other interviews. But
I think after Bruce, it was Miron Scher.
Yes, yeah.
He worked with us for a time at Berkeley Carroll also. Might have been Noel Fabiano was there.
Yeah, and I had wondered when you mentioned Robert, because speaking of Miron Scher, Robert Hess also became a student of his. But
he was Bruce's, yes, I remember that.
Okay, but you didn't teach.
I didn't find him, but I found somebody who's going to be the next Dr. Fauci.
That's, definitely important work. So glad to hear that. And one other thing I wanted to ask you about, Carol Ann, was, and you do touch on this in the book, is the difference between teaching chess in classes as opposed to after school and mm-hmm. morning settings, mm-hmm. like preschool and after school.
Right. It's a big difference. As I said, when they're in the classroom, they're there because they have to be there. Okay? It's regimented. When you're teaching after school, you have a great deal of freedom. And you have to earn your classes. As I said, it's market driven. If you're not doing a good job, they're not signing up, period. So it's an entirely different atmosphere. Did that answer the question?
Yeah. So what are there adjustments that you can make if you are teaching in a classroom setting, or do you just kind of have to suck it up?
In the classroom setting, you can do a lot more lecturing. Okay. Because they can't get up and walk away.
Right.
So yes, I did a lot more lecturing when I was teaching chess in the schools, which I did for, I don't know, 10 years, 12 years, quite a while. And, you know, then you let them play afterwards. After school, they want to get to the play as soon as possible.
Yeah, that makes sense. And one of my favorite stories from the book, Carol Ann, was of the two dads getting in a fight. Could you share that one?
You know, I don't know what goes through some of their heads. The question to me is, what did that little boy feel? There was a boy, I guess he was maybe a fourth grader, a third grader, and a second grade girl. And he had been in the class, the young boy, since he was at least in kindergarten, as had she. They're playing a game. Parents' Day is very traumatic for a lot of the kids because the parents are watching. And you know what Parents' Days are, I presume.
Yes, but you should explain for the listeners.
Parents' Day is the day at the end of the trimester where the parents show up to see what's going on in the class and, you know, coo about how wonderful their children are.
Right.
And on this particular day, two fathers were there. And the father of the older child, the boy, felt it necessary to tell his son how to beat the little girl.
Yeah, telling him moves, basically.
Yeah, telling him moves, exactly. Well, that didn't go down all that well with the father of the little girl, as you can imagine. There was quite a loud confrontation that I had to break up there. But it did teach me one thing. And it served me well. I think I talk about this in the book also for many years. And that's on Parents' Day. Every parent gets the instruction. I made up the 6-foot rule. You hug and kiss your child. You move 6 feet away. And you do not interfere. And parents who break that rule, it does not end well for them. Sometimes, like I mentioned earlier, the mothers don't try to steamroll me so much, but those fathers will try to steamroll me. What could she possibly know? But what goes through a father's head? Maybe you could tell me. When he goes, what does he think he's accomplishing by telling his son how to win the game? That son is not trustworthy to beat the little girl? What is he thinking?
Yeah, it's probably not fully thought through, but I guess that one would think they're helping them build confidence, which is kind of the opposite. But
exactly the opposite.
Yeah, and you mentioned in the book both of these dads were medical doctors, right?
Absolutely, high paid medical doctors. in some, you know, fine educational facilities in Brooklyn.
Yeah. Amazing. That's why it's important to have good teachers and good after school teachers as kids, so that, you know, they can learn emotional control while they're still young.
Yes. That's a very important thing to teach.
Yeah. And I was curious, Carol Ann, as someone who's been teaching for decades and has seen sort of the rise of devices for kids over the years, do you notice anything different in kids' attention spans for the limited time that you're teaching each kid per week?
I have to say no. Not in the kids that I've been teaching. I'm lucky that a lot of my students are in Park Slope, and we have really excellent public schools here, never mind the private schools. But I can't say that I did. Now, when you talk about the upper echelon, that's an entirely different story.
What do you mean by the upper echelon?
You know, people who are playing high stakes tournaments.
Yeah. And of course, we have plenty of talk on this podcast about all of the issues related to cheating with devices. But yeah, even studying with devices obviously has changed the game a lot.
That's exactly why I told you, if you want to work with your daughter, pull out Fisher's 60 Memorable.
Yeah, I have to admit, Caroline, I think that one's a little too advanced for my 7-year-old, but I have some ideas.
I wouldn't say it was, because you remember that when Fisher's playing these games, he's at most a teenager.
It's true. And he does have a unique clarity for a grandmaster in the way that he plays, but I think I might start with Morphe or, of course, Judith. Because when you look at Judith's games when she was young, she also played.
I would agree with that. I could agree with that. And then work your way up to Fisher.
Yeah.
Well, Fisher lives around the corner and studied around the corner.
Yeah, Brooklyn legend.
Yeah.
So another thing that really resonated with me from the book was your discussion of how to handle the touch move rule. And this is another one that obviously classroom chess teachers grapple with, but even for people teaching kids at home, whether they're parents or just relatives, what's your philosophy on whether touch move should be enforced?
Always. Well, not always. When you're talking about 4-year-olds learning the game, don't bother with it. But children will tend to think with their fingers. And that's one of the things that I always tell, think with your brain, not with your fingers. And not only that, but I don't want arguments in my class. I don't want the vitriol. I don't want the distraction from playing the game. So anything that will reduce the chance of two kids standing and accusing each other of cheating, anything that I can do to lessen that. In fact, I don't let them use the word cheat.
Yeah, and they always want to. You know,
of course.
Yeah.
It deflects from their own responsibility by saying you cheated.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's an important sort of life lesson where they also if someone doesn't know a rule, if they move a piece the wrong way. Kids are quick to say they cheated, when often it's they made an honest mistake, you know.
Right.
But then some kids really do cheat, so it's it's a fine line.
I found that the not knowing the moves and rules, that's early on,
right?
Early on in the chess experience, and the youngest kids will try and use that as an excuse to see what they can get away with, how far they can push the boundaries. Will their opponents notice? Okay. By the time they're older, it's certainly a genuine mistake.
Yeah. And then you have these sort of gray area scenarios where a piece gets knocked down and maybe it gets put back on the wrong square. And then you have to try to assess someone's character about whether it was an honest mistake or not. And
I'll go back further on that, because if they can't tell me how the piece got to that square, I can disallow any conversation that they're saying afterwards. Where was it before it was there? What were you thinking? Where were you going? And then you can compare the stories of the two players about where the piece was and how it got there. And if you can't resolve it, game over.
That's a good draconian rule, I would say.
We'll be right back with more teaching advice from Carol Ann Caronia.
And we are back. One other point I wanted to highlight from the very end of the book was you talk about how the educational system has perhaps changed in the wake of COVID, or maybe some problems that were already there became more highlighted. But you write, we cannot rely on the school system to fill all the needs of the children. They have shown they cannot or will not always do so. It's up to you. I would love to hear you expound on that, Carolyn.
Well, I'm not knocking the teachers, because I've known enough teachers in my life to know how dedicated and wonderful so many of them are. But the system was exposed during COVID, when the parents got to see how the children were learning and what they were learning and why they were learning it. And I think the parents have to bear some responsibility in that, at least in since I was in school and afterwards, the parents relied heavily on the school to perform the task and did not look far enough, did not explore far enough what was going on. And I think COVID exposed that as a big mistake on the parents' part. The parents have to look. They have to see. They have to know if their child is learning and what the child is learning and how they're learning it. I think that's my major point. But am I making sense to you?
Yeah. It definitely struck a chord with me. You know, I'm lucky in that the schools where I live are also pretty good, but that can cause one to check out, and that you shouldn't do that.
Right. In other words, you have to take responsibility for what you can't just lay it on the school.
Yeah.
Okay. The parents have to take the responsibility also.
Yeah, and I certainly agree with you with what you say about the teachers are doing amazing work with limited resources in many cases. So it's certainly not a condemnation. Of their work. And Carolyn, as someone who's been teaching chess in Brooklyn for all these years, you know, chess has been popular in New York kind of all along, but from your perspective with Queen's Gambit in the past couple of years and all of the online stuff, like, do you notice a difference in how popular chess is?
Maybe a little bit, but you know, my classes were full, pretty much full all the way through. It's at Berkeley Carroll. It was not unusual to have 25 to 30 kids in a class at Garfield Temple. We would get as many kids and classes as were possible to stuff in. There were years when I was doing four classes there. The same at 107. There's many times less children in the younger classes, but that's expected. So there was always a high interest here. And a lot of them come at least partially knowing. As I say, grandpas are great teachers.
Yeah. Yeah. And it comes up fairly frequently, like whether or to what extent chess teaches any transferable skills to kids. What's been your perspective? I mean, you tell a lot of great stories. I mean, again, you're kind of in an unusual atmosphere in that you're teaching a lot of very bright students with very solid foundations in terms of their family lives, but I'm curious what skills you think chess might help these kids with.
Well, I think the book is basically about how to get your child's mind to think logically, and to what kind of exercises to do to promote that, which is also tied to critical thinking and problem solving, which is one of the reasons they get things like the young ones will get things like mazes. The older ones, I might give other kinds of them, solving mysteries or doing other kinds of puzzles generally. Or even when I'm choosing who's playing who, sometimes I make them solve puzzles. I would give them, you know, write down your name in numbers instead of in letters. And then add them all up until you get one digit. And you have to think about those kinds of things. Am I answering the question?
Yeah, and actually it made me think of another question, because when I was teaching, sometimes, and again, I feel like this happened more often with girls than boys, I would have students who only wanted to do puzzles instead of playing. What's your philosophy when you get that request?
Play first, puzzles later.
Okay.
I can be a little tough.
You can, yeah, but I did find it interesting what you said, and as we touched on earlier, about like the volume of the classroom, where you kind of accept it, that it's not going to be quiet there.
No, it's not going to be quiet there. But you're here in a chess class, you're here to play chess. You can do the puzzle, you can do it later, not now.
Yeah. Well, Carol Ann, this has been, I mean, I really enjoyed the book, as I said, and a lot of good lessons, I think, especially for teachers, but also for parents. Did you, like, who would you say the primary audience you had in mind when writing the book was?
Parents. And, you know, I kind of thought of those homeschoolers, people who are homeschooling their children. I think that might be a good audience. Not only the children, the parents of children who are in the public schools, but people who are looking for ways to stimulate their child during homeschooling. And that's not only when they're teaching them, but also getting the kid together with kids they may or may not know to interact.
Yeah, I know that homeschooling is becoming increasingly popular, and that parents often...
Yeah, the numbers are skyrocketing.
Yeah.
So I thought that would be a growing audience.
Yeah. And do you have any resource recommendations, whether it be for chess club teachers or for parents looking to give books or online resources to their kids in terms of what to use?
I can't give any specifics, but I mean, I'm always searching all kinds of places to look for things that might be helpful. You want me to name some? I can't right off the bat.
Okay. I mean, I certainly can and have before. So I'll give a shout out to Everyone's First Chess Workbook by Peter Giannatos and the Jeff Coakley books, as I have many times. So, but I'm curious, Carol Ann, if you do use puzzles, like, do you just have ones that you made or got a long time ago? Or what do you use for the mazes, for example?
I had plenty of mazes books.
Okay.
That I copied and gave to the children there. I have many of them. As a matter of fact, that was one of my COVID pastimes, was going through my filing cabinet and giving away all the duplicates of all the mazes that filled.
Right.
But I also have mysteries, and there are several handheld little, not electronic, little, you know, games where you have to arrange the pieces into certain patterns, etc.
I haven't seen those. I'll have to try to get my hands on those, because I do, like, there are mazes in
The mazes work because I discuss it in the book also. It's a great way to start teaching even the youngest children how to analyze the thought, correct their mistakes, and to keep going until you solve the problem.
Yeah, and the kids, again, as I mentioned before, the kids love them. So that's a good thing as well. So the book is called Strategic Moves, Mind-Bending Exercises for Kids. Definitely a lot of fun, especially if you're teaching or have younger kids. So Carol Ann, anything to add before we say goodbye?
Well, I just want to thank you for having me.
Sure.
It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, thanks.
And buy the book.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks for sharing your insights. And it was nice to chat, Carol Ann.
Thank you again.
Podcast Network.